Fantastic. Thank you. So I know it's your Friday. I know you're in very comfortable seats, and I know that we need to keep the energy levels up. So my goal is to make this informative and also try to make it a little bit fun and engaging as well. I've been on the road for about 3 weeks, so I've been delivering this content many, many times, and so I like to keep things interesting for myself. And so if you have questions, if you have things that you like or things that you know you just want to talk about, then please definitely raise your hand or shout out. I mean, let's make it interactive. It's kind of hard to see some of you because of the lights, so if I don't see you raising your hand, please throw something at me. Also, I want to thank Martin for organizing this great event. Martin, I've had the pleasure to work with for the past few years over email, and so it's great to be able to meet Martin and be able to put a name to a face. He's one of our top sales specialists around the world, so I'm not just saying that because he bought me dinner last night. So absolutely, if you have questions or want to talk about adopting some of these great technologies, please definitely look up Martin. He'll definitely work hard for you. So my name is Brian Keller. I'm a technical evangelist back in Redmond. So I've been on the road here for 3 weeks, like I said, talking about this, and it's really what I love talking about. I work on Visual Studio. I started off about 8 years ago working on a language called J#. And some of you might remember that. I'd like to think that I've come a long way since then because now I get to work on Visual Studio Team System or what the marketing team is now calling Visual Studio 2010 Application Lifecycle Management, because we were all starting to learn Team System, so they have to go change things on us, of course. I'm also on Channel 9, so if you're looking for another podcast to add to your weekly viewing, we publish a show every Friday. We talk about what's going on across the Microsoft developer ecosystem, and we like to have a little bit of fun as well. And I maintain a blog. The reason I'm showing you my blog is that I've actually taken all of the content that I'll be showing you today, and I've packaged it up as a virtual machine that you can download. So if you like what you see, or if you want to share this with other team members back in your organization, definitely go home and you can download the virtual machine either in Hyper-V or virtual PC, and then you can run almost every demo that I'm showing. The only exception is some of the lab management components that I'll be showing later on this afternoon are not supported by that single VHD. But everything else you can go home and play with, and I also have 9 hands-on labs, so it's about 6 or 7 hours worth of content that you can use to actually go through all the demos and dive deeper into an area that might be of interest to you. And I also recently co-authored a book. This is Visual Studio 2010 Application Lifecycle Management. So if this is an area that interests you, the book is about 700 pages, covers everything from Team Foundation Server to software testing to some of the architect capabilities. And so definitely check out my book if that interests you. And if not, there's a lot of other great books that are coming out at this time. So this is not a marketing presentation. I'm not going to be spending all day lecturing you about the various components that make up the products that go into Visual Studio 2010. I'll leave that to Martin, but I did just want to briefly talk about some of the things that you'll be seeing today. You'll notice here that if you're familiar with the 2008 product lineup, we've greatly simplified the number of Visual Studio SKUs that we have. So in the past, we had an architect edition, a development edition, a testing edition, and a database professional edition. We've done a lot of work to collapse that functionality into what we now refer to as Visual Studio Premium and Visual Studio Ultimate. As Martin mentioned, these products will ship on Monday. So if you're an MSDN subscriber, you'll start to see some of these products show up on the download center. And we also continue to have Team Foundation Server that sits at the heart of a lot of the functionality we'll be talking about today. And then we have this new capability called Lab Management as well. So during the last session of the day, I'll be showing you how Lab Management helps you take all of your software and build that, deploy it into a virtual environment, test it as well, and then be able to really complete that entire end-to-end development and test lifecycle. So I want to drop into a demo, but you know, as I just showed you, one of the things that we'll be needing today, of course, is Team Foundation Server. And so I thought that what we would do is actually install Team Foundation Server before we get started. Now, has anyone actually gone through the process of installing Team Foundation Server before? Wow. Okay, so I apologize to you. It was not easy, was it? You know, Team Foundation Server 2005 and 2008, it might take you on a good day 4 hours, on a bad day a couple of days to get everything all set up. So we have a rather bad reputation there. The reason for that, of course, is that we originally targeted Team Foundation Server at kind of the enterprise level. So we took a dependency on SharePoint. We took a dependency on reporting services, on Windows Server, on SQL Server. And so you had to make sure that everything was all set up just right in order to complete everything, and then you might get halfway through the installation and realize you've got a bug because you didn't have a dependency that was set up originally. So I thought what we'd do start with is actually show you some of the improvements we've made in terms of setting up Team Foundation Server 2010. Now, I've been on the road for 3 weeks. I've done this a lot myself already. I would love to actually get a volunteer, someone hopefully who's never set up Team Foundation Server before, to come on down and help me set this up. Any volunteers? I know it's early on a Friday morning, but anybody at all? Somebody? No? I might have to call someone out of the audience then. That'd be fun. No? Okay. Yeah, we've got one. All right. Thank you very much. Big round of applause. And what is your name? I'm sorry?
Jan
Martian. Jan Martian. Okay, all right. All these names that are not American, it's hard for me to pick up on. Sorry about that. So we've never met before. We haven't practiced this. None of that. Okay, fantastic. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you and just have you, you know, knock yourself out and install TFS. Now, have you set up TFS 2010 before? Have you set up Team Foundation Server before?
Never.
Never. Fantastic. You're perfect.
Never
so.
Never
set up Team Foundation. All right, so it'll be a first time for you. So I'm not going to tell you anything, so you can go right ahead. Whoops. You already broke it. Sorry about that. I really did not mean to set this up so that it would break. Let's see. Okay, this is my fault. I think we had some problems right before where someone knocked my hard drive off. No, I'm not pointing fingers or anything, but let's see. Bear with me here. Talk amongst yourselves. Team Foundation Server. Okay, yeah. Back on track.
Really easy.
Yeah. That's my fault. I'm kind of a walking data center up here. I've got my laptop with multiple hard drives inside of it. I've got an external hard drive. I've got a second laptop. Airport security loves me because you know, I've got all these different demos I've got to run. So once we get back up here, go ahead and get started. So where are you from?
Cinnamon.
So, another name I can't pronounce. Where is that?
Yulan.
Where is that?
Yulan.
Oh, gosh. All right. Maybe we should just focus on installing stuff here.
I also say I'm from Rascal Festival. That's a company.
Okay. Yeah. Hmm. Well, this worked everywhere else. Let's see here. It worked on my machine, exactly, yes. We'll be talking about that later on, yes. You know what? In the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and skip to the rest of my demos, and I'm going to have you back on stage. You're going to stick around today, right? I haven't scared you off or anything. Okay, fantastic. Well, I'm going to have you back on stage later on, and we'll go ahead and set this up after I've had a chance to restore my image. So we'll go ahead and have you take a seat, and we'll call you back down later on. Okay, fantastic. Thank you. Nice job. So that's what happens when you knock the power off your demo machine right before you get started. So we will set that up later on because I do think that it's pretty interesting and it's a nice look at some of the enhancements that we've made to really give TFS give everybody a chance to use Team Foundation Server. The other thing that we've done is we've made a lot of investments in setting up Team Foundation Server at the enterprise level as well. So if you're interested in setting this up across multiple machines for high availability, we've made a lot of investments there. And so this is your basic Team Foundation Server topology, where you can set up everything on a single machine, which is what we'll do later on, I promise. And then what you can also do with that, of course, even in 2008, is you can separate this across multiple machines as well. So you can have an application tier and a data tier, and that sort of helps you scale out as well. In addition to that, you can also put a front-end network load balancer in 2010 and have multiple application tiers. And so this gives you really nice load balancing, it gives you redundancy, it gives you high availability in the event that you need to take one of the nodes offline. And then the other thing that we've done is we've introduced the concept of a team project collection. And so a team project collection allows you to take what used to be just team projects and contain those into multiple team projects per team project collection. And the nice thing about that is that if you, let's say, for example, have a Team Foundation Server instance set up, and it has 50 different team projects on it, and then you realize that one of those team projects actually has a lot more people hitting it than you expected, and you want to move that over to a new Team Foundation Server. In 2008, that's kind of tricky to do because the data gets spread across multiple databases. Well, now with the team project collection model, you can actually pick up a single database that corresponds to your team project collection, and you can move that to another physical server very easily. The other nice thing is that if you're a consultant and you work on a project for a customer, and at the end of that project, you want to hand that project off to the customer so that they can continue doing their own development, this makes it easy to do that as well. So you put everything into a team project collection, you take it offline, and then you move it over to their Team Foundation Server, and then you restore it back on that system. And then you can also take all these different components and you can move them across multiple physical machines as well. So you can have SharePoint on one machine, your build server on another machine, your data tier spread out across multiple machines. So we really want to give you the most flexibility possible as you start taking Team Foundation Server and scaling it up and out across your organization. You could also put everything on a single machine as well. So in the case that we were going to set up a Team Foundation Server on my laptop, we could really have everything on my single laptop. So let's actually check in there. Yeah, it's still not loading. We'll take a look at that later on. So during today, I'm basically going to be talking about a few different areas of Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management. The first area we'll talk about is the architect tools, ways that we can help you understand your existing code base, break down that code base so you can start to understand the dependencies and the different mappings across your existing system. From there, we'll also jump into some of the project management capabilities. So you've decided to plan a sprint or an iteration. How do you actually break down that work and assign it to individuals? We'll be taking a look at some of the higher-end development capabilities of Visual Studio 2010, so branching, merging, a new capability called IntelliTrace that can help you do advanced debugging, and then for most of the time that I have with you today, we'll be talking about some of the new software testing capabilities. So hopefully there's going to be something in here for everybody in the room, or if an area doesn't interest you directly, maybe it's something that you want to take back to your team and point them at the hands-on labs so that they can actually go back and install some of this for themselves and see some of what we've delivered here. So to start with, let's drop into my other virtual machine, and we will be talking about some of the architecture capabilities. And like I said, at any time, if you have questions or just want to have a discussion around something, definitely feel free to interrupt me. So what we see up here is the sample application we'll be using most of the day. It's called Tailspin Toys. It's a basic e-commerce application, so I can go into model airplanes here. I can add an item to my cart. I can check out. Nothing fancy here. It happens to be a web application, but everything that I'm going to show you today WPF. So let's start with trying to understand my existing database. But maybe something that I haven't worked with in 6 months or so I want to reverse engineer and understand exactly how all this code works. Or maybe, bear with me here, let's pretend that you didn't have any documentation. I know everyone in here has great documentation, it's all up to date, but let's pretend that you didn't and try to understand exactly what's going on within this solution. So within Visual Studio 2010, we can, first of all, generate what's called a dependency graph. And so we have a few different options for doing that, by assembly, by namespace, by class. I can even come in here and generate my own custom dependency graph. When I do that, it allows me to specify, okay, what do you want to look at? You know, maybe I'm interested in just all the public types. Maybe I want to share this with another team. It's a library that I make available to them. A number of options for configuring this. And over on the right-hand side, we show you what a sample graph might look like. But for here, let's go ahead and just generate a graph by namespace, or I'm sorry, by assembly. And what this is doing is it's reverse engineering my .NET code base into a DGML diagram. DGML is a standard for modeling your project, and so what you can do is you can actually use DGML with other tools that operate against DGML as well. And so what you can see here is that very quickly we've generated 2,800 nodes and 10,000 links, and we've given you this diagram that I can explore as well. So here you can see these are the different assemblies that make up my solution. And I can, for example, drill into generics, and this expands generics, and I can zoom in, and I can say, okay, maybe I'm interested in the dependency for this shopping cart item, this func, and so we will click on one of the dependencies, and so this will take us straight to another dependency, so you can see shopping cart item, so that's nice to start to explore and understand the various dependencies as they relate across my types, my classes, my namespaces, my assemblies, and so on. Let's go ahead and collapse this then. So I can just say group, collapse all, back to the original graph, and you notice I have this externals down here, so if I expand externals, we can see the way that my solution relates to other assemblies that I may not have source code for. So maybe this is a third-party library, maybe this is the .NET framework. In fact, that's a lot of what we're looking at right here. So you can see MS Core library. And so maybe I don't actually want to represent this on the diagram, so I'll just hit delete. Of course, that doesn't delete MS Core lib from my system. That would be bad. Looks like there's a couple different versions here, so we'll go ahead and delete that. And we start to simplify my diagram. And so maybe I don't need system.dll because, of course, every solution is going to use that. And so we've simplified our diagram. Now, what you'll notice is that we have these arrows, and they stop at the dependency diagram. They stop at the border for externals. And so we've done that by design to sort of simplify the diagram, because otherwise we would have arrows going all over the place, and it would look just like a mess. But let's say that I actually did want to go ahead and show exactly how my solution relates to the individual assemblies that make up externals. So what I can do is I can just say remove group. And now what it's done is it's put everything on the same plane. Another thing to point out is that the thickness of the arrows actually has meaning as well. So if we take a heavy dependency on something, you'll see a very thick arrow in the graph. And if we have a very light dependency, of course, then it'll be a very thin arrow. So that's one nice way of generating some dependency information and understanding the way that my system relates to another. I can also right-click, and I can use some of the analyzers in here. So, you know, I can find circular references or hubs or maybe unreferenced code. If I want to clean up old code that may not be within my solution, I can very quickly walk through my solution to understand that. So as long as your solution makes use of managed code, so .NET Framework 2.0 or above, then you could take advantage of the dependency graph that we have in here. Another way of looking at this is to use what's called the Architecture Explorer. So if we click on Architecture, go to Windows, Architecture Explorer, what we can do is actually drill in based on either class or based on solution. So I'll go ahead and drill in based on the solution, and actually by class is what I wanted to do, and then we'll look at the tailspin.admin.app. And from there, you can see that there's basically these verbs that relate one box to the next. So we have all the types that are contained within here. So if we look at the types, we have app, main window, let's say product relationship. That looks interesting. We have different members within here. So product relationship, that looks interesting. Or product, let's say. And let's say get product. And you can see that that's where it ends, because get product doesn't actually call anything. But what we could do is we could click on one of these verbs as well, and say, well, instead of actually what does get product call, let's say where in my solution do I reference that get product. And so we're starting to get a little bit recursive now. We go back to product, and so of course get product and set product. So then we can look at this visually as well. So what we've done is we've actually remembered left to right everything that I did in order to drill down into this point. And so now what we do is generate this diagram, also DGML. We can take set product and see how this fits in with the diagram, drag and drop it up there. And so now what we're doing is we're starting to generate documentation. So once again, if you're in a spot where you need to update some of your documentation or you need to understand exactly how a solution you may have inherited relates to one another, these are some great tools for doing that. Yes? Fantastic question. Do we have any plans for unmanaged code? So right now, this tooling does not support native code like C++. It doesn't support even Java, for example. But we've built this extensibility into these tools. And so over time, we do want to deliver support for things like native code. We're working with partners to look at, can we generate some of these same diagrams for Java code, for example. So the extensibility is there. In this release, you'll see us delivering this support around .NET framework code. So, great question. Okay, so another thing that we've done within 2010 relating to the architecture tools is we've also implemented support for UML. And so in the past, you may have used a tool like Enterprise Architect or Visio to work with your UML diagrams, and then you've kind of had to jump back into Visual Studio to work with your actual code. Well, in 2010, we have support for 5 different UML diagrams. And so these are all UML 2.1.1 compliant, I think. I'm looking to my architect friend over there. 2.1.1, I think, Clemens? Oh, .2, fantastic. So if we look at the use case diagram, for example, you can see that we have our actors relating to the various use cases that they perform. And so this not only gives you a nice drawing surface for working with your UML diagrams, but it really goes beyond just a drawing surface as well. So we have a UML model explorer that shows all the different objects that across all of your different UML diagrams. And so if you update one object that happens to be referenced in another diagram, it will update in all those places. But the other thing that you can do, which I like, is you can say right-click, and you can create a work item off of this. So if you're using Team Foundation Server to coordinate the work across your team, I could generate a UML diagram, and then I could start to assign work to Clemens and say, okay, this is the UML diagram that I intend, and I want you to go implement this particular behavior. And so he gets in the morning, and he takes a look at the tasks that are assigned to him, and he not only gets the information saying, hey, I need you to implement this, but he can then look back at the UML diagram, and he can understand the way that his work relates to the other work, or he can understand the way that changes that he's making to an existing system may interoperate with the existing system that's in there. Another thing that we can do is we can actually reverse engineer a sequence diagram as long as you're using managed code as well. So if we look at, for example, tailspin.web, and we have controllers, and let's say that Clemens comes to me and he wants me to change the way that some of the shopping cart behavior works. And so I come in here and, you know, I've never seen this code before, and he wants me to change the way that remove item works. And so today, if you think about the way you might go about making this change, I might F5 this application, I might set a few breakpoints, I might start going to go to definition and jumping all over the place and trying to understand the way that the code works today before I start making changes. But wouldn't it be nice to be able to generate a sequence diagram from here? So what I can do is I can actually right-click now and say generate sequence diagram. It asks me things like how many levels do we want to go within the call hierarchy. And so we'll just take the defaults, and it's going to reflect against my existing code, and then it's going to give me a sequence diagram. So right away, I can understand exactly what happens when this remove item is called. And so that's pretty nice. The other thing I could do, let's say I'm Clemens again, and I want to propose changes to this workflow. I can take this diagram as a starting point. I can make changes to that sequence diagram, and then I can assign that work back to somebody else. So it's a great starting surface for starting to design the way you want to make changes moving forward. So for the architecture tools, I've saved my favorite for the last, and that is the layer diagram. And so we've all seen layer diagrams. We've drawn these up on whiteboards. You know, it's basically like, hey, I have an MVC application, so you know, let's draw out my model, my view, my controller, and let's go party on. So let's say Clemens does a lot of work, and he puts together this layer diagram, And he sends it out to his team, and the team says, great, you know, hangs it up on the wall, and then they start coding, and, you know, 5 minutes later, what they're coding no longer matches what Clemens just spent all weekend creating for us, right? This happens all the time. And so we go beyond just having a basic diagram within here. We actually make this diagram map back to your solution, so you can then do things like validate the solution against the diagram and see if you have any changes that you need to make in order to remain compliant with all the hard work that Clemens did putting this diagram together. And so if we take a look, for example, at controllers, I can drill into the links, and you can see that in creating this diagram, I've also associated all the individual classes that make up the various components within this diagram. So now Visual Studio has knowledge about which classes are allowed to call one another. And so you can see here that we have bidirectional arrows in some cases, we have one directional arrows, and the direction of an arrow is actually important. So for example, MVC is allowed to call into my infrastructure library, but the infrastructure is not allowed to call back to MVC. And so to make this interesting, let's right-click and let's say validate architecture. And once again, it's going to reverse engineer my code base. It's going to tell me whether or not the existing diagram that I have actually conforms to the code that I've written. And sure enough, it doesn't. So if we take a look at some of the errors in here, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these, but basically if we double-click on one of these arrows, it's going to take us to an invalid call that's happening within my solution. So let's say that actually, you know, I want to use my existing code base as a starting point. I maybe made a mistake when I was putting together the diagram. I want the diagram to now reflect what the reality is within my solution. So I can do the reverse here, which is to say generate dependencies. And now what it's going to do is it's going to go the other direction and say, let's change the diagram to match what my code base is. And so what you can see here is we've actually added some bidirectional dependencies. And so for those of you in the front row with sharp eyes, you may have noticed that these became bidirectional. And so now if I revalidate this architecture, then everything should pass, and that's great. Now, what I can do is I can now take this diagram, and I can make this something that all of my developers can use when they're building their solutions. And so when they press F5, we can either have it trigger a warning or an error when they're adding code so that they can see, oh, okay, I actually made a call that no longer conforms to Clemens' diagram. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that it relies on the individual developer to sort of make sure that they're conforming and that they're not just ignoring the errors and checking the code in anyway. And so one of the things I'll show later on is a new capability called gated check-in within Team Foundation Server. And you can think of gated check-in as a way to prevent anybody from checking in code which is going to break the build. What we do is we actually build the code ahead of time before committing it back to your repository. And so the layer diagram validation is one of those validations that you can add to your build check-in so that if someone does try to check in code which no longer conforms to the great diagram that Clemens spent all weekend on, we can make sure that it kicks that code back to them and says you need to remove this invalid dependency before you're allowed to check that code in. So that's a pretty cool way of ensuring that your architectural integrity remains compliant. Also, I should mention that patterns and practices, so the Microsoft Patterns and Practices team that puts together the enterprise library guidance and a lot of other guidance that's available on MSDN, they've actually shipped a number of patterns as well that you can download as existing layer diagrams. So you can start with like MVVM or Model View Controller, and you can start with those diagrams, and then you can start mapping that to your existing solution. So those are available for download now to use as starting points. So let's say that you know, we understand our existing code base, we understand the changes that we want to make, and let me just back out some of these changes here. What we want to do next is we want to start scheduling some of this work. And so you know, my customers come to me and they've given me a list of all the different changes that they'd like to have us add to the application, and so one of the things that we've done is we've tracked that within our work item hierarchy. And so these are all the work items within Team Foundation Server. If I take a look at the product planning backlog, we can see here that we've taken the work and we've given it a priority. We've assigned it some story points. So this is just a rough order of magnitude calculation about exactly how much time we think that these these user stories are going to take to implement. So you may have your own way of prioritizing, but the bottom line is you have a list of things that you want your application to do, and you're going to continue to add those capabilities over time. Now, in Team Foundation Server 2005 and 2008, we give you this sort of work item view in a flat list. We let you store all the work. It's really great for tracking work. I can see who's working on something. I can see how much work is remaining. But it's not really a great tool today for actually planning your work. When it comes time to decide how much work can we take on within the next 2 weeks, or let's say how much work does Clemens have on his plate? Does Martin have on his plate? Who's going on vacation? You know, all those different things that are the reality that you face when you're starting to plan some of your projects. Those are questions that we sort of leave to your own devices to figure out how to answer. So you go to the whiteboard, and you go to Microsoft Project, and you put together a project plan. But we've done a lot of work now within Team Foundation Server 2010 to help enable this end-to-end planning experience. The other thing that we've been asked for and we've delivered in 2010 is hierarchical work items. And so as you start to take a look at a requirement, you might want to break that requirement down into a few different areas. So what's the individual list of work that we're going to do in order to enable that requirement? So that may break down into a number of different tasks that your developers go out and implement as they're delivering on that requirement. And so what we can now model in TFS 2010 is a parent-child relationship between the user stories or the requirements and their child tasks that will take to implement that. And we then allow you to report against that as well. So you'll see how we can report against a requirement and show you just how much work is remaining by rolling up all the information about the individual tasks that go into that work item. We can also say that maybe we want to have a tests and a tested by relationship. So not only are we delivering on this capability, but are we making sure that it's of high quality as well? And so that's another type of relationship you can represent within the hierarchical work items that we support. And so you'll see me refer back to that throughout the day, because really Team Foundation Server, at the end of the day, it's more than just a source control solution. It's more than just a work tracking solution. It's more than just a build solution. The fact that all of these are available within one solution allows us to do some really neat things in terms of the way that we light up reports and help you steer those projects over time. And so to see how that starts to come together, let's take you through a basic product planning scenario. So I mentioned that we allow you to use some workbooks now to help plan your iteration. So let's open up one of those workbooks that we ship, which is the product planning workbook. And this is going to launch Microsoft Excel. Everything that I'm doing, you could also do within Visual Studio. I'll show you how you can do the same thing within Microsoft Project as well. And so when you install Team Explorer on a machine with Excel installed, we also add this new ribbon tab. And so this allows us to connect back to Team Foundation Server. We can refresh those work items just to make sure we have the latest in our workbook. And so this is the same list of work that I was looking at within Visual Studio. So over on the right-hand side, you can see that I have some work that I implemented within the last iteration. I'm in the middle of iteration 2 right now, so I have some work that's currently being implemented. And then I have a backlog of future work that I want to implement as well. And so we might want to start taking some of these items off the backlog and planning iteration 3. But in order to understand how much work we can take on, we first need to define what iteration 3 is going to look like. And I think that next week starts on the 12th and goes to the 16th. So let's just define my iteration for next week. And let's say that we have 3 people working on this iteration. And so you can see my historical information for the previous iterations. So in iteration 1, we were able to take on 20 story points and deliver those, which is great. But for iteration 1, we also had 4 people working on the team. So for iteration 2, we actually had 3 people working on the team. Iteration 3, we also have 3 people. So we might want to compare ourselves against the amount of work that we took on for iteration 2. And so if we feel comfortable with that work, you can see that we were able to deliver 3 units of work so far. Maybe we're still working on another 11, but we feel pretty confident with that amount of work. And so let's take on that same amount of work within iteration 3. And so if I hop back to the product backlog, I can start to assign these to iteration 3. We'll just take a few items off the backlog here. Go back to iterations, and you can see, all right, looks like we can probably take on a little bit more work. We're currently planning 10 units of work, so let's go back to the backlog. And if I look at the number of story points that we've done, looks like the next one's 9, 7. Those are probably too big, but 4 story points seems reasonable. We'll assign that to iteration 3. And then that looks about right. So very quickly, I'm able to manage my backlog. And so now what I can do is I can publish this back to Team Foundation Server. So that's the first phase. That's saying, you know, from a very high level, how much work do we think we'll be able to take on based on our current estimations of how much work is within the system. But we still haven't answered the question of, you know, who is going to do this work? You know, I know Martin's going on vacation. I know Clemens is, you know, not such a fast worker, right? So we need to figure out exactly how much work we can take on. So we have another workbook, which is the Iteration 3 backlog. And if I just refresh this one. Then what you can see is that a couple of things happened. First of all, we pulled in all the work that we assigned to iteration 3, and we also have this hierarchy represented as well. So the first level of hierarchy is the user story. So that's the list of things we want to deliver to the customer. You know, maybe give customers the ability to pay with a credit card when they're checking out of our online store. That might be a user story. And then at the second level of hierarchy, we have the child tasks that go into implementing that requirement. And so you see that, you know, for example, as a store administrator, I should be able to track all open orders. And so in order to realize that, I need to create a database view, I need to implement a web front end, I need to design that web front end. I've already done some work here to break down that user story into the child tasks. And so I've already actually assigned some of those tasks, so I've done a little bit of this work already. You can see how much remaining work we have. Down here at the bottom, though, I have a new user story that I popped off the backlog, which I haven't broken down yet. So let's go ahead and do that. I'll add some child tasks. So you can see I can just very quickly start modeling everything within Excel. I'm going to save you from my typing skills here, do some copy-paste magic. And so now I have 3 new tasks. And if I look at those individual tasks, I've actually already assigned them to who I want to perform those tasks. And I've assigned them to iteration 3. Let's take the rest of these tasks and assign them to iteration 3 as well, and we'll go ahead and publish that. So now we've broken down my work, but we haven't answered the question of just how much work an individual can take on. So if we take a look at my iteration, once again I'm going to define the length of that iteration, and I'll come into capacity and we'll pick who on my team is actually working on this iteration. And this is pulling all that data straight from Team Foundation Server. And how many hours a day they're going to work. Let's say that they can actually do 5 hours of work per day with interruptions and everything else. And so quickly we start to get an individual and a team level breakdown showing exactly how much work is currently assigned. So this looks pretty good for Abu and for Doris. They've got, you know, plenty of capacity, but I'm a little bit worried about April. She, you know, she has a lot of work on her plate. She's not quite over capacity, but it would be nice if I could rebalance some of this work. So if I come back into my iteration backlog, you know, Abu is a nice guy, and he knows how to do this, so he's going to say, I'll take this item off your plate. It looks like it's a pretty big work item. So we'll assign that to Abu. We'll go back to our capacity tab, and you can see we've quickly balanced things out. And of course, you know, now April comes to us and says, you know, since Abu's taking care of that, I think I'm going to use next week to take a vacation. So she's going to go on vacation the 12th and the 13th. And actually, you know what? The 12th is a big holiday for us. Actually, let's call it a company meeting. So no one's going to get any work done. So now we've modeled our interruptions within this workbook, come back to capacity. Now, of course, April is overcommitted, and that's not good. So we can come back to the backlog and say, you know what? We had the best intentions of taking on this additional user story, but in reality, we don't want to put the rest of the work at risk. So we'll pop that back onto the backlog. and now everybody's happy. So, you know, maybe I want to take another item off the backlog or find a way to balance this work, but I'm not going to do that. What I'm just trying to show you here is that we can quickly go through and plan our work now. So you can quickly make adjustments. Everything's stored within Excel here, so you can even model this, to represent other dependencies that you may have. Within Microsoft, I've seen teams do things like take into account bug counts. So, you know, it's one thing to say we're going to do a lot of new work, but we also probably need to do some maintenance work on other applications or fix bugs that we introduced in the last iteration. And so you can start to take a look at some of those incoming bugs and make those model those assumptions within your planning tool. Other things you can do are say things like, which skills are assigned to each developer. So, you know, maybe Clemens is really good at writing PHP, but he's not so good at writing T-SQL stored procedures. And so let's make sure that we assign him only things that correspond to his skill set. And so you can start to really model this make it an even more useful tool for your teams. And so now at this point, I can just publish this, and that data is going to show back within Team Foundation Server. So now, if you want to look at this within Team Foundation Server, we can also start to work with a hierarchy in there as well. So we can open up the iteration backlog. Here you can see I've modeled the same hierarchy here. So I have my user stories, I have the child tasks. I can even do some things that you may not expect. Like I can take this and drag it to another user story. I can change some of the indentation. Maybe I want to create, children and grandchildren now. Maybe I want to take this user story and add another child task. So I'll create a new linked work item. You can see some of the different relationships we support, child, parent, predecessor, successor. You can even create your own relationships as well. So we really give you a lot of flexibility. Incidentally, I should mention that this is something that has been in use. The work item hierarchy was one of the first features that we enabled within the early pre-releases of Team Foundation Server. And in fact, Windows 7 and Office 2010 took advantage of these capabilities as well. So if you like Windows 7, a lot of what they did was actually start with their value proposition. So, we want to deliver this feature and we want it to, maybe not be like Vista, that sort of thing. And then they started to add all their tasks in order to make that a reality, and so they were able to track that and start at the very highest level so that someone like Steven Sinofsky could go in there and say, okay, this is my pet feature. I want to make sure this is something that ships. Show me just how much work is remaining to make sure we implement it and we test it and we make sure it's a great feature. And so this is something that we're really excited to be able to deliver in 2010 so that you can take advantage of that as well. Let me just back out my changes so you can see that everything was bold prior to saving it in case I make a mistake. Now, you may also want to use a tool like Microsoft Project to start to create a project plan as well. So I'll just open up this same list of work items within Microsoft Project. And some of this stuff you could actually do within 2005 and 2008. But the problem was that Project supports things like parent-child and successor-predecessor, which TFS 2008 did not understand. So you were caught in the situation where you had to create this project plan and maintain it over here, and then you had the reality of the work that was taking place within Team Foundation Server, and you had two different islands of data. Now that we support the same notion of parent-child and successor-predecessor, we can model everything within Project, push that back to Team Foundation Server, and at any time I can regenerate my project plan. So it's a full bidirectional synchronization. So just to give you a quick example of how that works, let's say that maybe implementing the web front end is something that we want to do after we design the web front end. Go figure, seems like a good idea, right? So we can model that as a predecessor relationship. And so now Actually, I did that in the opposite direction. You guys in the front row are supposed to keep me honest here. Four. There we go. Does that work? Yeah. So now before we actually implement the front end, we're going to design the front end. And so now you can start to build your project plan. And Project 2010 has some really great resource allocation tools. So we can make sure that, for example, you can see here that April is actually doing a lot of work on Friday. We want to make sure that we're able to schedule her and spread that work out over the course of her week so we can start to do some resource allocation. And I really like Project 2010 for that. So if we go back to Team now, we can now publish these changes. And if we go back and look at, that is work item 34. Open up work item number 34. Look at the links. And there we have our parent link represented because that's all represented within TFS now. So that's great. Let's also show you one of the things that we have for reporting, because in TFS 2005 and 2008, we shipped a lot of great reports out of the box, and these can start to show you things like burn down and how's your test plan progressing. The problem with that is that almost inevitably, somebody starts to use the process templates or the process guidance that Microsoft ships, and they start to make changes to that to represent the reality of how you actually do your work. And that's great. We want to encourage that. The problem with that is that when you start to make those changes, you might start to break some of those reports that come out of the box, and then you've got a whole heap of work to do to go fix those reports. Or maybe you look at the reports that we ship, and you say, you know, we'd really like to have this other report that allows us to show some existing things as well. Wouldn't it be nice for us to create that report? And you take a look at the MSDN library documentation, you say, whoa, that's going to take us like 2 weeks, and you don't end up creating that report. And so because the value of TFS is really, as I said, putting all these systems into one place, and we can start to, you know, link your source code with your work items, with your builds, we want to give you great options for being able to extract that data out of Team Foundation Server as well. So a key investment for us in this release was to do ad hoc reporting and really give you that capability. And so one of the things that we realized is that developers like working with queries. Queries are really easy for us to understand. And so wouldn't it be great if we could take a query and turn that query into a report that we could use to watch over time? And so let me just create a new query here. And so I'm going to be pulling in work items. Let's say that what I'm actually interested in is work that's assigned to my team. And so in TFS, we don't really have the concept of a logical team. Like, we may have 20 developers that are working on a project, but I don't have a concept that represents the way that that Clemens's team may be different than the way that my team works. And so since I'm a manager of my own team, I want to create some reports that show me exactly how my team is performing. And so what I can do is I can start to pick off some of these users here and say, I'm interested in work items that are assigned to people on my team. Maybe just get one more here. And let's pick Doris. And so we'll just group this. So now if I run this query, you can see a list of all the work items that are currently assigned to these three people. So that's nice to be able to look at and be able to go into Visual Studio and update that on a regular basis. But I want something a little bit more visual because, you know, I'm a manager, so I don't like going to Visual Studio. So let's instead go ahead and save this query, my team. And let's take this and create a report in Microsoft Excel. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to look at that query that I put together originally, and we're going to make some inferences about the types of reports I might be interested in from that query. And so for this particular query, it should be telling me that I have some current reports that I can look at to show work that's currently assigned to the team, and then also some trend reports as well. So how has this work actually changed over time? And so I can start to see historical data so that maybe I can figure out just how much work my team is capable of taking on. And so we'll select both types of reports. Go ahead and generate that. And in just a few seconds here, you can generate what would have taken you weeks with TFS 2008 or 2005 to generate. So here's work items broken down by work item type. So I see I have bugs, tasks, test cases. These are all pivot charts, so it's really easy to change this data. Here's the work broken down by the users that it's assigned to, by state, active, closed, design. We also have trends. So if you look at some of the trends, you can see how this data has changed over time. It's also easy to change these as well. So if I come back to, let's say, work that's assigned to individuals, over on the right-hand side, we can see the way that the data warehouse breaks down within Team Foundation Server. And in the past, if you tried to go under the hood and look at the data warehouse, it wasn't really something that was very friendly for you to look at. So we've done a lot of work to make sure that that we can make it really easy. So if I come down to work item, for example, somewhere in here, there's the work item. Let's say I wanted to see how this work breaks down by area path. And so an area path within Team Foundation Server allows you to define like different feature areas or different logical areas within your project, maybe you know database versus website versus presentation layer. And so here you can see that I've quickly broken that down just by adding an additional column within there. And so now what I could even do is I could take this report and either save it off as an Excel workbook that people could open up manually, or if I have Microsoft Office SharePoint installed, then what I can do is I can actually publish this back to Excel services, and then that report will then show up on a dashboard. So I might want to have my own page within SharePoint that shows me my team, and then likewise, Clemens wants to have his own page that he uses to see his team. And so that's a really nice thing that you can do. I'm not going to do it because I don't have Moss installed on this machine. So that's pretty cool. We're pretty proud about the Agile reporting capabilities. Let me just show you a few of the additional reports that we have within here. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through each one of these, but I've put them all in my slide deck so that if you want to take a look at the rest of these in detail later, you can. But here's where a lot of the information that I've described earlier with respect to the hierarchical work items really starts to light up. So let me just spend some time talking about this one. Over on the left-hand side, you can see the hierarchical work items between a parent and child relationship. So you can see, for example, we have, as a new customer, I want to be able to order a meal. And so moving left to right, we now see how much of that work's actually been implemented. And so what we're doing is we're rolling up all the individual tasks that make up that particular user story into that column. So you can see that it's 80% of the way implemented. Then on the right-hand side, we have the measure of quality as well. So you can see that I have some test cases that are passing. Green is good, right? We have some test cases that are failing. Red is bad. And then we have some test cases that haven't been run yet. Maybe they haven't been written yet, or maybe they just haven't been run for the latest build. But we can see that represented, and we can see the number of bugs. And so now very quickly, as a stakeholder for this project, I can get a quick sense for exactly what kind of quality is going on within this iteration based on the work that we've currently bitten off. And so this is something I might be comfortable sharing with a customer or certainly someone that's higher up within my organization who has a responsibility for making sure that my team is doing a great job. Here's one of the dashboards that you can start to light up once you integrate Team Foundation Server with Microsoft Office SharePoint services. And so what you can see here is that I've got my burn downs as it relates to bugs or as it relates to things like, over here on the left-hand side, you can see our burn downs, so how much work is remaining, quality, how much work, or how are the test plans progressing against that work. And so what I can do is I can drill into different perspectives. And so here's my bugs perspective. Here's my build perspective. So the last, 10 builds or so, how is the data actually mapping up? Or is the quality going up or down? Hopefully it's going up. We take a look at the burn down. So how is that work coming along? And so just lots of really great information in here. And like I said, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on here. Here's another drill down on the individual builds, how those are progressing over time, and how that data is coming out of team build and populating within TFS. More burn downs. Here's another interesting one. This is what's called reactivations. So the default workflow we ship with Team Foundation Server for the Agile template. Yes, question back there. Fantastic question. Let me actually show you that after I get done with the reports. So the question was, will there be the ability for an individual customer to report bugs straight back to Team Foundation Server by using the SharePoint site? So I'll show you exactly how that works. That's a great question. So the way reactivations work is that the workflow for a bug by default is active, meaning a tester's found a bug and assigned it to a developer. Resolved, meaning that Clemens has promised us that he's checked in code and that's actually fixed the bug. And then closed, meaning that the tester has verified that that fix is correct. But what happens if the tester looks at a bug that Clemens says that he fixed and actually the test is still failing? Well, that results in what's called a reactivation. And so this is the type of report that you can see that shows you your reactivations over time. And so maybe Clemens is not doing a good job of fixing his code. Maybe I, as a tester, am actually getting a lot of false negatives. And so I'm realizing that my tests don't actually map up to what the developer is trying to implement. But this is a type of report that allows us to have that conversation and say, hey, we might have a mismatch in between the way that the developers and the testers are working together. remaining work. So like I said, just lots of reports in here. Let's get to this gentleman's question, which is to show how we can actually do a lot of this work over the web as well. So in Team Foundation Server 2008, we shipped a power tool that allowed you to set up web access back into Team Foundation Server. And so in 2010, we've actually built that into the products. You don't need a separate power tool anymore. If I go to my project portal, this opens up a SharePoint dashboard again. So in 2008, that was called Team System Web Access. And now Team Web Access is actually integrated as part of 2010. So if I come over to the left-hand side, we have this Team Web Access. While that's loading, the other thing I'll point out is that our licensing changed in 2008 to make it more flexible. So that if you have a customer that wants to be able to file bugs back to Team Foundation Server directly and not have to, you know, call someone on the development team and have them file a bug, in 2005 that would have required that your customer actually had a license to connect to Team Foundation Server. Well, in 2008 and 2010, we make it possible for you to give the customer access to file bugs and file enhancement requests without requiring a client access license. So I know that Martin could spend some time going over some of the details from a licensing perspective, if you're interested in that. So here we can see all the individual bugs that are within my project. I can select multiple projects if I have them over on the left-hand side. I can take a look at my work items. So for example, represented within web access client. So I could open this up. I could create a new bug if I had permissions. So you may want to give your customers specific permissions so that the new bugs they create goes into one area that you then triage before deciding whether or not you want to assign that work back to developers. So you have that flexibility. We can even give customers the access to the source code. So if they want to open up your existing source code and get a read-only view to that, maybe you want to point them at this to install the latest daily builds if they're a little bit more savvy, then you can do that and give them access straight to your Team Foundation Server repository or one area of TFS. We can access build data as well. So this is Team Web Access. Like I said, you don't have to do anything special in order to enable this. Once you set up Team Foundation Server, this just gets installed by default now. So let me just consult my list here and see the next thing we were going to talk about. I think that we're on to branching and merging, and we are. So branching and merging is something that we've supported since TFS 2005. So we give you the ability to create branches and use branches to actually isolate your work and allow you to promote data or promote changes from one branch to another so that you can make sure that changes get well tested before they get out pushed out into the production branch and go to the customer and that sort of thing. But one of the problems that a lot of people have is that as their branching strategy gets more and more complex and a project grows over time, it can become difficult for developers on the team to understand exactly how that branching strategy works. It can become difficult for you to understand how to manage changes across the different branches that make up your source control. And so we've done a lot of work to not only give you that foundation for doing branching and merging, but now also to help you understand more accurately exactly the way the work breaks down across your system. And so let's go ahead and model a change within my system. And so to start with, I have a few different branches over here. I see iteration 1, iteration 2, main. I also have this release branch where I have a production website that's running over here. So this is a snapshot of what's currently running in production. And the marketing team has come to me and said, hey, the website's great, we're selling lots of planes, but we keep getting all these complaints because some of these links down here don't actually work. And so this is something that is actually on the production website right now. So we need to fix this. Now, the challenge we have is that the development team is working against iteration 2 right now, and they're not scheduled to actually ship that release until Wednesday of next week. And so, we're looking at a situation where the earliest we'll have a fix is Wednesday of next week. And that's not good because this is a real problem that exists today. And so what we may decide to do is we may decide to fast track a change into production, meaning we're going to make that change directly to the production node. And so we've decided that's a change that's important enough to do. And so if we open up our production branch and come into my solution. And go into my website. We have this template.master, which is where all those links are stored. And this is a very simple change. We can just take this code or this markup and go ahead and comment that out. So we'll save that change, push it back to Team Foundation Server. So I'm going to give it a check-in comment. This will actually become important later on. So we're saying removing dead links from bottom of page. We'll check that in. So that's great. We've fast-tracked that change into production, and let's assume that we've already deployed that change, and so now it's available out on my production website. But remember, we have an entire development team that's working against iteration 2, and they didn't get that change because we made this change to the production branch. And so what will happen is on Wednesday, when they push their changes live, unless we take account for this change, they're going to reintroduce those broken links back into the website. And so what I've decided to do is actually take that change that I just modeled within the production branch and merge that back into the iteration branch so that that becomes available within the current project. So this is something that you might be doing within your own projects. You can probably think of lots of examples along these lines. And so my job as the build engineer or as the lead developer here is to now take those changes and move them back into iteration 2. And so if I look at this particular branch, and come into properties, we can start to understand that we have this relationship here. So production relates back to main, but I still don't know how production relates back to iteration 2. And so what I can do is I can now visualize the way that all my branches relate to one another. So if I go to branching and merging and view hierarchy, we can see here's how production 1 relates to main again. But let's take a look at the full hierarchy, and now you can see okay, this makes a lot of sense. So now we have production 1 is a child of main, and then main is this integration branch, which is the parent for merging changes across iteration 1, iteration 2, and production 1. So this isn't a lecture on branching and merging strategy. We can have that discussion separately. But basically just picture any branching strategy you might have today, and we can model that within this hierarchy. So that gives me a start. So now I know that in order to go from production 1 into iteration 2, I need to go through main. So if we look at those changes, go to view history, you can see that I have this change that I just introduced. So this is a change set within Team Foundation Server. And I can now right-click and say track change set. And so track change set asks me to tell it which branches I'm interested in examining as I try to figure out whether or not this change has been pushed over to those other branches. And so iteration 1 happened 2 weeks ago. I don't care about that anymore. But iteration 2 is interesting because that's going on right now. So we'll visualize that. And now you can see right away, remember, green is good. We can see that the change has been introduced in production 1, but it's not yet available in those other branches. So now what I can do is I can drag and drop this onto main. It opens up my merge dialog. That's great. If I had any conflicts, it would tell me about those here. Now it's pinned that change. And I'm going to give a different comment. So, let's say I'm being lazy, moved some stuff from production to main, and we'll check that in. That's the technical term, right? Stuff. And we'll rerun this. Now you can see that we have a new change set that's been introduced. So green is good. So we're getting closer. Let's do the same thing. Go from main into iteration 2. And I have no idea what changes we're merging. This becomes important in a moment. So now we'll rerun that. And now green is good. So now we know that change is now available within iteration 2. But now let's put on my hat and say that, I'm poor Clemens sitting over here, and I've noticed that some changes have been moved over, but no one really gave me a good idea of exactly what happened. And in fact, if I look at this within Source Control Explorer, if I look at the history, this poor guy is having to look at this change and saying, I have no idea what changes are merging. This stuff happens all the time. Or maybe you're moving a bunch of stuff over, and the person who's merging this isn't going to take the time to say, all right, we moved the dead links, and we fixed this bug, and blah, 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 blah. So it can become really difficult to understand what were those changes which just got merged over. But if I look at this particular change, I can see that this is a change to template.master. And so that gives me a starting point. And so if we look at template.master within the iteration 2 branch, there's a capability called annotate, which we actually shipped with 2008 as well, that allows you to see on a line-by-line basis who made a change. And so we'll use that tool to see exactly which changes have been introduced within here. And so now I'm Clemens, I'm scrolling down, and I'm saying, okay, I see that the last change made to this file actually happened as part of this particular change set. And in 2005 and 2008, all you would see is that some stuff was merged into my branch. But now what we do is we actually go all the way back to the origin of intent, and we tell you exactly when that change was made. Okay, so this now shows that the change I made to this file was actually remove these dead links. And so that's really important. It's a scenario you may have faced within your own organizations as well, where it becomes difficult once you start having multiple branches to understand exactly what's going on. So this is a really helpful tool that we've done a lot of work in order to enable what seems like a simple scenario, but this is something that can cause a lot of headaches for people today. One last thing with respect to branching and merging is I can also take a look from a timeline perspective. So if I go back to change set and track that. Oops, wrong way. Let's look at the other branch. Sorry about that. We can look at timeline tracking. And so what this does is it gives us a view over time and shows us exactly when this change was introduced. And so this can be important if you have a customer that's calling, for example, and says, hey, you know, I'm having this problem on my production website. And you say, well, gosh, that sounds like a bug that we fixed last week. When did you get the latest build? So they say, okay, well, you know, we're running the build you sent us on Friday. So, okay, great. So we take a look at the system and we see that we made that bug fix on Wednesday. But in reality, that bug fix didn't actually make it out to the build that you're receiving for Friday because it wasn't actually merged and tested until Monday. So this can start to answer those questions. And so you can say, all right, we clearly need to get you Monday's build because you're missing that bug fix. So those are just a few ways that that branching and merging hierarchy works. The other thing I want to show you is some of the new changes that we've made with respect to builds. So I talked a little bit about builds earlier on. How much time do we have left for this session? So we're at time. Okay, so we'll go ahead and pause now, and then we'll take a break, and I'll resume talking about builds in my next session. And what time are we back on?
11.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you.